not long for this world, and I'd hate myself if I never told you." Confusion flashes across her face, and I barrel on before she starts asking questions. "I miss you." I hope she hears what I'm truly saying. "I love you. I'm sorry. I wish I could fix it." "I'll always miss you, even when I'm a ghost." I release her and take a step away. Then another. I turn my back on her, my heart clenching at the strangled sound she makes, and walk out of the alley. The only footsteps I hear as I leave are my own. The depot is pure pandemonium, with tribesmen throwing children and goods into wagons, animals rearing, women shouting. A thick dust cloud rises in the air, the result of hundreds of caravans rolling into the desert at once.
"Thank the skies!"
Laia spots me the moment I appear beside Afia's high-sided wagon.
"Elias, why?"
"You idiot!"
Afia grabs me by the scruff of the neck and hurls me up into the wagon beside Laia with remarkable strength, considering she's more than a foot shorter than me.
"What were you thinking?"
"We couldn't risk Aquila seeing me surrounded by members of Tribe Nur. She's a mask, Afia. She'd have figured out who you were. Your tribe would have been at risk."
"You're still an idiot."
Afia glares at me.
"Keep your head down. And stay."
She vaults onto the driver's bench and grabs the reins. Seconds later, the four horses pulling the wagon jerk forward, and I turn to Laia.
"Izzy and Keenan?"
"With Gibran."
She nods to a bright green wagon a few dozen yards away. I recognize the sharp profile of Afia's little brother at the reins.
"Are you all right?"
I ask her. Laia's cheeks are flushed, and her hand is white-knuckled on the hilt of her dagger.
"Just relieved that you're back,"
she says.
Did you talk to her? To Aquila?"
I'm about to answer when something occurs to me.
"Tribe Scythe."
I scan the dust-choked depot.
"Do you know if they got out? Did Mamie Reeler escape the soldiers?" "I didn't see."
She turns to Afia.
"Did you?"
The tribeswoman fidgets, and I catch her glance. Across the depot, I see wagons draped in silver and green, as familiar as my own face. Tribe Scythe's colors. Tribe Scythe's wagons. Surrounded by marshals. They drag members of the tribe out of the wagons and force them to their knees. I recognize my family. Uncle Akbi. Aunt Hira. Bleeding Hells. Sean, my foster brother.
"Afia," I say. "I have to do something. That's my tribe."
I reach for my weapons and edge to the open door between the wagon and the driver's seat.
"Jump. Run. Come at them from behind. Take the strongest first."
"Stop!"
Afia grabs my arm in a vice-like grip.
"You can't save them. Not without giving yourself away."
"Skies, Elias."
Laia's face is stricken.
"Torches."
One of the wagons, the beautiful, mural-decorated Kihani wagon that I grew up in, goes up in flame. It took Mamie months to paint the peacocks and fish and ice dragons that adorned it. I'd hold the jars for her sometimes and wash the brushes. Gone. So fast. One by one, the other wagons are put to the torch until the entire encampment is nothing but a black stain against the sky.
"Most of them got away,"
Afia says quietly.
"Tribe Scythe's caravan is nearly 1,000 strong. 150 wagons. Of those, only 12 were caught. Even if you could get to them, Elias, there are at least 100 soldiers out there."
"Orcs," I say through gritted teeth. "Easy to beat. If I could get swords to my uncles and Sean..."
"Tribe Scythe planned for this, Elias.
Afia refuses to back down. In that moment, I hate her.
If the soldiers see that you came from Nur's wagons, my entire tribe is dead. Everything Mami and I planned for in the last 2 days, every favor she called in to get you out of here, it will all be for nothing. You traded in your favor, Elias. This was the prize.
I look back. My tribal family huddles together, heads bowed, defeated. Except for one. She fights, shoving at the Orcs who have grabbed her arms, fearless in her defiance. Mami Rila. Uselessly, I watch her struggle. Watch a legionnaire bring the hilt of his sim down on the side of her head. The last thing I see before she disappears from sight is her hands fluttering for purchase as she falls to the sands.
Chapter 22. Liar. The relief of escaping Nur does nothing to assuage my guilt at what happened to Elias's tribe. I do not bother trying to talk to him. What could I say? Sorry is a callous inadequacy. He is silent in the back of Afia's wagon, staring out at the desert in the direction of Nur, as if he can use his willpower to change what happened to his family. I give him his solitude. Few people want witnesses to their pain, and grief is the worst pain of all. Besides which, the guilt I feel is almost crippling. Again and again I see Mamie's proud form crumpling like a sack of grain emptied of its bounty. I know I should acknowledge to Elias what happens to her, but it seems cruel to do so now. By nightfall, Nur is a distant cluster of light in the sweeping blackness of the desert behind us. Its lamps seem dimmer tonight. Though we fled in a caravan of more than 200 wagons, Afia has split her tribe a dozen times since then. By the time the moon rises, we are down to 5 wagons and 4 other members of her tribe, including Jabran.
He didn't want to come.
Afia surveys her brother, perched atop the bench of his wagon a dozen yards away. It is covered with thousands of tiny mirrors that reflect the moonlight, a creaking, trundling galaxy.
But I can't trust him not to get himself or Tribe Nur into trouble. Fool boy.
I can see that, I murmur. Jabran has lured Izzy up into the seat beside him, and I've caught flashes of her shy smile all afternoon. I glance back through the window into Afia's wagon. The burnished walls of its interior glow with muted lamplight. Elias sits on one of the velvet-clad benches and stares out the back window.
Speaking of fools, Afia says, what's between you and the redhead?
Skies. The tribeswoman misses nothing. I need to remember that. Keenan has ridden with Riz, a silver-haired, silent member of Afia's tribe, since our last stop to water the horses. The rebel and I hardly had a chance to speak before Afia ordered him to help Riz with his supply wagon. I don't know what's between us. I am wary of telling Afia the truth, but suspect that she could pick out a lie a mile away. He kissed me once, in a shed, right before he ran off to help start the Scholar Revolution.
Must have been quite the kiss, Afia mutters.
What about Elias? You're always staring at him.
I am not that I blame you.
Afia continues, as if I haven't spoken, casting an appraising eye back at Elias.
Those cheekbones. Skies.
My skin heats and I cross my arms, frowning.
Ah! Afia flashes her wolfish smile. Possessive, are we?
I have nothing to be possessive of. An icy wind blows down from the north, and I huddle into my thin tribal dress. He's made it clear to me that he's my guide, and nothing more.
His eyes say different, Afia says. But who am I to get between a marshal and his misplaced nobility?
The tribeswoman raises her hand and whistles, ordering the caravan to a halt beside a high plateau. A cluster of trees stands at its base, and I catch the shine of a spring and the scrape of an animal's claws as it patters away.
Gibran! Easy! Afia calls across the camp. Get a fire going! Keenan!
The redhead drops down from Riz's wagon.
Help Riz and Vana with the animals.
Riz calls out something in Sardis to his daughter, Vana. She is whip-thin with deep brown skin, like her father, and braid tattoos that mark her as a young widow. The last member of Afia's tribe is Zare, a young man about Darin's age. Afia barks an order at him in Sardis, and he gets to it without hesitation.
Girl, Afia is, I realize, speaking to me. Ask Riz for a goat, and tell Elias to slaughter it. I'll trade the meat tomorrow.
And talk to him. Get him out of this funk he's in. We should leave him be.
If you're going to drag Tribe Nur into this ill-advised attempt to save your brother, then Elias needs to come up with a foolproof plan to do so. We have 2 months before we reach Koth. That should be enough time. But he can't do it if he's moping. So fix it.
As if it's that easy. A few minutes later, Riz points me to a goat with an injured leg, and I lead it to Elias. He guides the limping animal to the trees, out of sight of the rest of the caravan. He doesn't need help, but I follow anyway with a lantern. The goat bleats at me, mournfully.
Always hated butchering animals.
Elias sharpens a knife on a whetstone. It's like they know what's coming. Nan used to do the butchering in our house, I say. Some of Pop's patients paid in chickens. She had this saying, "Thank you for giving your life, that I may continue mine."
Nice sentiment, Elias kneels. Doesn't make it any easier to watch it die.
But it's lame. See? I shine the lantern upon the goat's wounded hind leg. Riz said we'd have to leave it behind, and it would die of thirst. I shrug. If it's going to die anyway, it might as well be useful. Elias draws the blade across the animal's neck, and it kicks. Blood pours onto the sand. I look away, thinking of the tribesman, Shikart, of the hot stickiness of his blood, of how it smelled, sharp, like the forges of Sarah.
You can go.
Elias uses a mask's voice on me. It is colder than the wind at our backs. I retreat quickly, mulling over what he said. Doesn't make it any easier to watch it die. Guilt sweeps through me again. He wasn't talking about the goat, I think. I try to distract myself by finding Keenan, who has volunteered to make dinner.
All right,
he asks when I appear beside him. He looks briefly toward Elias. I nod, and Keenan opens his mouth as if to say something, but perhaps sensing I'd rather not talk, he just hands me a bowl of dough.
Need it, please? He says. I'm terrible at making flatbread.
Grateful to have a task, I get to it, taking comfort from its simplicity, from the ease of having only to roll out discs and cook them on a cast-iron pan. Keenan hums as he adds red chilies and lentils to a pot, a sound so unexpected that I smile when I first hear it. It is as soothing as one of Pop's tonics, and after a time he speaks of Adisa's great library, which I've always wanted to visit, and of the kite markets in Io that stretch for blocks. The time passes quickly, and I feel as if a bit of the weight on my heart has been lifted. By the time Elias has finished butchering the goat, I flip the last pieces of charred, fluffy flatbread into a basket. Keenan ladles out bowls of spiced lentil stew. The first bite makes me sigh. Nan always made stew and flatbread on cold fall nights. Just the smell of it makes my sadness seem further away.
This is incredible, Keenan.
Izzy holds out her bowl for a second helping before turning to me.
Cook used to make it all the time. I wonder...
She shakes her head, and for a time, she is quiet.
I wish she had come, my friend finally says. I miss her. I know it must sound strange to you, considering how she acted.
Not really, I say.
You loved each other. You were with her for years. She took care of you.
She did, Izzy says softly. Her voice was the only sound in the ghost wagon that took us from Antium to Sarah, after the Commandant bought us. Cook gave me her rations, held me in the freezing nights. Izzy sighs.
I hope I see her again. I left in such a hurry, Lyra. I never told her.
We'll see her again, I say. It's what Izzy needs to hear. And who knows? Maybe we will.
And Izzy, I squeeze her hand. Cook knows whatever you didn't tell her. In her bones. I'm sure she knows.
Keenan brings us mugs of tea, and I take a sip, closing my eyes at the sweetness, inhaling the aroma of cardamom. Across the fire, Afia lifts her mug to her lips, and promptly spews out the tea.
Bleeding burning skies, scholar! Did you waste my entire honey pot on this?
She tosses the liquid onto the ground in disgust, but I curl my fingers around the mug and take a deep sip.
Good tea is sweet enough to choke a bear, Keenan says. Everyone knows that.
I chuckle and smile at him. My brother used to say that when he made it for me. As I think of Darren, the old Darren, my smile fades. Who is my brother now? When did he transform from the boy who made me too sweet tea to a man with secrets too heavy to share with his little sister? Keenan settles in beside me. A wind howls out of the north, battering the flames of our fire. I lean close to the fighter, savoring his warmth.
Are you all right?
Keenan dips his head toward me. He takes a lock of hair flying across my face and tucks it behind my ear. His fingers linger at my nape, and my breath catches.
After.
I look away, cold again, and reach for my armlet.
Was it worth it, Keenan?
Skies, Elias's mother, his brother, dozens of members of his tribe, I sigh.
Will it even matter?
What if we can't save Darren?
Or if...
He's dead.
Family is worthy dying for, killing for. Fighting for them is all that keeps us going when everything else is gone.
He nods at my armlet. There's a sad longing in his face.
You touch it when you need strength, he says,
because that's what family gives us. I drop my hand from the armlet.
I don't even know I'm doing it sometimes, I say. It's silly.
It's how you hold on to them.
Nothing silly about that. He tips his neck back and looks up at the moon.
I don't have anything from my family. I wish I did.
Some days I don't remember Lys's face, I say. Just that she had light hair. Like mother.
She had your mother's temperament, too. Keenan smiles. Lys was 4 years older than me. Skies, she was bossy. She tricked me into doing her chores all the time.
The night is suddenly less lonely with memories of my long-dead sister dancing around me. On my other side, Izzy and Gibran lean toward each other, my friend giggling delightedly at something the tribal boy says. Riz and Vana reach for their ouds. Their strumming is soon accompanied by Zev's singing. The song is in Sardis, but I think they must be remembering those they have loved and lost. Because after only a few notes, it raises a lump in my throat. Without thinking, I search the dark for Elias. He sits slightly away from the fire, his cloak pulled tight around him. His attention is fixed on me. Afia clears her throat pointedly, and then jerks her head at Elias.
Talk to him.
I glance back at him, and that heady rush I always experience when I look into his eyes rolls through me. I'll be right back, I say to Keenan. I put down my mug and pull my cloak close. As I do, Elias rises in one smooth motion and moves away from the fire. He disappears so swiftly that I don't even see which direction he's gone in the darkness beyond the circle of wagons. His message is clear. Leave me alone. I pause, feeling like a fool. A moment later, Izzy appears beside me.
Talk to him, she says. He needs it. He just doesn't know it. And you do too.
He's angry, I whisper.
My friend takes my hand and squeezes.
He's hurt, she says. And that's something you understand.
I walk out past the wagons, scanning the desert until I spot the shine of one of his braces near the base of the plateau. When I'm still a few feet away from him, I hear him sigh and turn toward me. His face, blank with a sort of bland politeness, is lit by the moon.
Just get it over with, Lyra.
I'm sorry, I say. For what happened? I don't know if it's right to trade the suffering of Tribe Scythe for Darren's life. Especially when it doesn't even guarantee that Darren will live. I was planning a few demure and carefully chosen words of sympathy, but now that I've started talking, I can't seem to stop. Thank you for what your family sacrificed. All I want is for nothing like that to happen again. But I can't guarantee it, and it makes me feel ill, because I know how it feels to lose family. Anyway, I'm sorry. Skies, now I'm just babbling. I take a breath. Words seem suddenly trite and useless. So I step forward and grab Elias's hands, remembering Pop.
Touch heals, Lyra.
I hold fast to him, trying to put everything I feel into that touch. I hope your tribe is all right. I hope they survive the marshals. I'm truly, truly sorry. It's not enough, but it's all I have. After a moment, Elias lets out a breath and leans his forehead against mine.
Tell me what you told me that night in my room, at Blackcliff, he murmurs. What your Nan used to say to you.
As long as there is life, I can hear Nan's warm voice as I say it. There is hope.
Elias lifts his head and looks down at me, the coolness in his eyes replaced by that raw, unquenchable fire. I forget to breathe.
Don't you forget it, he says. Ever.
I nod. The minutes pass, and neither of us pull away, instead finding solace in the coolness of the night and the quiet company of the stars.
Chapter 23. Elias. I enter the waiting place the moment I fall asleep. My breath clouds in front of my face, and I find myself lying on my back atop a thick carpet of fallen leaves. I stare at the web of tree branches above, their foliage the vibrant red of autumn, even in the half-light.
Like blood!
I recognize Tristus's voice immediately, and scramble to my feet to find him leaning against one of the trees, glaring at me. I haven't seen him since the first time I entered the waiting place, weeks ago. I'd hoped he'd moved on.
Like my blood!
He stares up at the canopy, a bitter smile on his face.
You know, the blood that poured out of me when Dex stabbed me.
I'm sorry, Tristus. I might as well be a simple-minded sheep bleating the words, but the rage in his eyes is so unnatural that I would say anything to ease it.
Aelia's getting better, Tristus says. Traitorous girl! I thought she'd mourn for at least a few months. Instead, I visit her to find that she's eating again. Eating!
He paces, and his face darkens into an uglier, more violent version of the Tristus I knew. He hisses under his breath. 10 hells. This is so far from who Tristus was in life that I wonder if he's possessed. Can a ghost be possessed? Isn't it ghosts that usually do the possessing? For a moment, I'm angry at him. You're dead. Aelia's not. But the feeling passes quickly. Tristus will never see his fiancée again. Never hold his children or laugh with his friends. All he has now are memories and bitterness.
Aelia loves you.
When Trista spins toward me, his face twisted in rage, I hold up my hands. And you love her. Do you truly want her to starve herself to death? Would you want to see her here, knowing that it was your death that did it? The wildness in his eyes dims. I think of the old Tristis, the Tristis from life. That's the Tristis I need to appeal to. But I don't have the chance. As if he knows what I wish, he whirls and disappears into the trees.
You can soothe the dead.
The soul catcher speaks from above me, and I look up to find her sitting upon one of the trees, cradled like a child in its enormous, gnarled branches. A wreath of red leaves encircles her head like a crown, and her black eyes shine darkly. He ran away, I say. I wouldn't call that soothing.
He spoke to you.
The soul catcher drops down, the carpet of leaves muffling the sound of her landing.
Most spirits hate the living.
Why do you keep bringing me back here? I look down at her. Is it just for your amusement? She frowns.
I didn't bring you this time, Elias, she says. You brought yourself. Your death approaches swiftly. Perhaps your mind seeks to understand better what is to come.
I still have time, I say. 4, maybe 5 months if I'm lucky. The soul catcher looks at me pityingly.
I cannot see the future the way some can.
She curls her lip, and I sense she's speaking of the augurs.
But my power is not insignificant. I sought your fate in the stars the night I first brought you here, Elias. You will not live past Rathana.
Rathana, the night, began as a tribal holiday but has spread throughout the empire. For marshals, it's a day of revelry. For the tribes, it's a day to honor one's ancestors. That's 2 months away. My mouth is dry, and even here in the spirit world where all is dulled, dread grips me. We'll have just made it to Koth by then, if we're lucky. The soul catcher shrugs.
I know not the small tempests of your human world. If you are so distraught with your fate, make the best use of the time you do have. Go!
She flicks her hand, and I feel that jerk in my navel, as if I'm being pulled through a tunnel by a great hook. I wake beside the dimly glowing embers of the fire, where I bedded down for the night. Riz paces outside the circle of wagons. Everyone else sleeps. Gibran and Keenan by the fire, like me, and Lai and Izzy in Gibran's wagon. 2 months. How do I get to Koth and free Darin with so little time? I could urge Afia to go faster, but that would only lead to us getting there a few days earlier than planned, if that. The watch changes. Keenan takes Riz's place. My eyes fall on a cold box hanging from the bottom of Afia's wagon, where she had me pack the goat I butchered earlier.
If it's going to die anyway, might as well be useful.
Liar's words. The same applies to me, I realize. Koth is more than 1,000 miles away. By wagon, it will take 2 months, true enough. The Empire's couriers, on the other hand, regularly make the journey in 2 weeks. I won't have access to fresh horses every 12 miles the way the couriers do. I cannot use the main roads. I'll need to hide or fight at a moment's notice. I'll need to hunt or steal everything I consume. Even knowing all of that, if I head to Koth alone, I can make it in half the time that it would take the wagons. I don't wish to leave Lyra. I will feel the absence of her voice, her face, every day. I already know it. But if I can make it to the prison in a month, I'll have enough time before Rathana to break Darin out. The Telus extract will keep the seizures at bay until the wagons get close to the prison. I will see Lyra again. I rise, coil my bedroll, and make for Afia's wagon. When I knock on the back door, it takes her only a moment to answer, despite it being the dead of night. She holds up a lamp, raising her eyebrows when she sees me.
I usually prefer to get to know my midnight visitors a bit better before I invite them into my wagon, Elias, she says. But for you...
That's not why I'm here, I say. I need a horse, some parchment, and your discretion.
Escaping while you still can?
She gestures me inside.
I'm glad you've come to your senses.
I'm getting Darin out alone. I step in the wagon and drop my voice. Faster and safer for everyone that way.
Fool! How will you sneak north without my wagons? Have you forgotten that you're the Empire's most wanted criminal?
I'm a mask, Afia. I'll manage. I narrow my eyes at the tribeswoman.
Your vow to me still stands. You will get them to cough. But you'll get him out yourself? There will be no need for Tribe Noor's assistance?
No, I say. There's a cave in the hills south of the prison. It's about a day's hike from the main gate. I'll draw you a map. Get them there safely. If all goes well, Darin will be waiting there when you arrive in 2 months. If not...
I won't just abandon them in the mountains, Elias.
Afia bristles, offended.
They have taken water and salt at my table for Sky's sake.
She gives me an appraising look, and I don't like the sharpness in her eyes. Like she'll cut the truth of why I'm doing this out of me if she has to.
Why the change of heart?
Lyra wanted us to do this together, so it never occurred to me to do it alone. That part, at least, is true, and I let Afia see that in my face. I'll need you to give Lyra something from me. She'll put up a fight if I tell her.
She will, indeed.
Afia hands me parchment and a quill.
And not just because she wants to do this herself, though you both might tell yourselves that.
I choose not to dwell on that particular comment. A few minutes later, I finished the letter and drawn a detailed map of the prison and of the cave where I plan to stow Darin.
You're sure about this?
Afia crosses her arms as she stands.
You shouldn't just disappear, Elias. You should ask Lyra what she wants. It's her brother, after all.
Her eyes narrow.
You're not planning to leave the girl high and dry, are you? I'd hate if the man to whom I made my vow was without honor himself.
I wouldn't do that.
Then take Trera, Riz's bay. He's headstrong, but swift and cunning as a north wind. And try not to fail, Elias. I have no desire to break into that prison myself.
Silently, I make my way from her wagon to Riz's, whispering to Trera in soothing tones to keep him quiet. I snatch flatbread, fruit, nuts and cheese from Vanna's wagon, and lead the horse well beyond the camp.
You're trying to get him out on your own, then?
Keenan materializes out of the darkness like a bleeding wraith, and I jump. I didn't hear him. Didn't even sense him.
I don't need to hear your reasons.
He keeps his distance, I notice.
I know what it is to do things that you don't want to for a greater good.
On the surface, the words are almost sympathetic. But his eyes are as flat as polished stones, and my neck prickles unpleasantly, as if the second I turn around, he'll stab me in the back.
Good luck,
he offers a hand. Warily I shake it, my other hand drifting to my knives almost unconsciously. Keenan sees, and his half-smile doesn't reach his eyes. He lets go of my hand quickly and fades back into the dark. I shake off the uneasiness that has stolen over me. You just don't like him, Elias. I glance up at the sky. The stars still sparkle above, but dawn approaches, and I need to be well away before then. But what about Lyra? Am I really going to leave with only a note to say goodbye? On cat feet, I make my way to Gibran's wagon and open the back door. Izzy snores on one bench, her hands folded beneath her cheek. Lyra is curled in a ball on the other, one hand on her armlet, fast asleep.
You are my temple, I murmur as I kneel beside her. You are my priest. You are my prayer. You are my release.
Grandfather would scowl at me for sullying his beloved mantra so, but I prefer it this way. I leave and head toward Trera, waiting at the edge of the camp. As I climb up into the saddle, he snorts.
Ready to fly, boy?
He flicks his ears, and I take it as a yes. Without another look back at the camp, I turn toward the north.
Chapter 24. Helene. He escaped. He escaped. He escaped. I pace a groove into the stone floor of the garrison's main room, trying to block out the rasp of Faris sharpening his sims, the low murmur of Dex giving orders to a group of legionnaires, the tapping of Harper's fingers on his armor as he watches me. There must be some way to track Elias. Think. He's one man. I have the might of the entire empire behind me. Send out more soldiers, call in more masks, members of the Black Guard. You're their commander. Send them out after the tribes Mamie visited. It won't be enough. Thousands of wagons poured out of the city while I put down a staged riot after letting Elias walk away from me. He could be on any of those wagons. I close my eyes, wanting desperately to break something. You're such an idiot, Helene Aquila. Mamie Rila played a tune, and I tossed my arms up and danced to it like a mindless marionette. She wanted me at the storytelling theater. She wanted me to know Elias was there, to see the riot, to call for reinforcements, to weaken the cordon. I was too stupid to realize it until it was too late. Harper at least kept his head. He ordered two squads of soldiers assigned to quell the riot to instead surround Tribe Scythe's wagons. The prisoners he took, including Mamie Rila, are the only hope we have of finding Elias. I had him. Damn it all, I had him! And then I let him go. Because I don't want him to die. Because he's my friend. And I love him. Because I am a damned fool. All the times I lay awake at night, telling myself that when the time came, I needed to be strong. I needed to take him. It was nothing in the face of seeing him again, of hearing his voice and feeling his hands on my skin. He looked so different, all muscle and sinew, like one of his Telemann sims brought to life. But the greatest change was his eyes, the shadows beneath and the sadness within, like he knew something he couldn't bear to tell me. It gnaws at me, that look in his eyes, more than my failure to catch and kill him when I had the chance. It frightens me. We both know I'm not long for this world. What did he mean by it? Since healing him in the second trial, I've felt a bond with Elias, a protectiveness I've tried not to think about. It's born of the healing magic, I'm certain. When Elias touched me, that bond told me that my friend was not well. Don't forget about us, he said to me and Sarah. I close my eyes and allow myself one moment to imagine a different world. In that world, Elias is a tribal boy, and I am a jurist's daughter. We meet in a market, and our love isn't tainted by Blackcliff or by all the things he hates about himself. I hold myself in that world, just for a second. Then I release it, Elias and I have finished. Now there is only death. Harper, I say. Dex dismisses the legionnaires, turning his attention to me, and Farris sheathes his Sims. How many members of Tribe Scythe did we capture? 26 men, 15 women, and 12 children, Bloodstrike. Execute them, Dex says. Immediately. We need to show what happens when you harbor an Empire fugitive. You can't kill them, Farris glares at Dex. They're the only family Elias ever... Those people aided and abetted an enemy of the Empire, Dex snaps. We have orders. We don't have to execute them, Harper says. They have other uses. I catch Harper's intent. We should question them. We have Mamie Rela, yes? Unconscious, Harper says. The ox who took her was too enthusiastic with the hilt of his sword. She should come around in a day or two. She'll know who got Futurius out of here, I say, and where he's heading. I look at the three of them. Harper has orders to remain with me, so he cannot stay in Ner to question Mamie and her family. But Dex might kill off our prisoners, and more dead tribesmen are the last thing the Empire needs while the Scholar Revolution still rages. Farris, I say, you'll handle the interrogations. I want to know how Elias got out and where he's going. What of the children? Farris says. Surely we can release them. They won't know anything. I know what the Commandant would say to Farris. Mercy is weakness. Offer it to your enemies and you might as well fall upon your own sword. The children will be a powerful incentive for the tribe's people to tell us the truth. I know this. Yet the idea of using them, hurting them, makes me uneasy. I think of the ravaged house in Sera that Cain showed me. The scholar rebels who burned down that house showed no mercy to the martial children who lived there. Are these tribal children so different? In the end, they are still children. They didn't ask to be a part of this. I catch Farris's eye. The tribesmen are already restless, and we don't have the men to put down another riot. We'll let the children go. Are you insane? Dex shoots a glare first at Farris, then at me. Don't let them go. Threaten to throw them into ghost wagons and sell them into slavery unless you get some bleeding answers. Lieutenant Atreus. I flatten my voice as I address Dex. Your presence is no longer needed here. Go and divide the remaining men into three groups. One goes with you to search east, in case Futurius makes for the Freelands. One with me to search south. One stays here to hold the city. Dex's jaw twitches. His anger at being dismissed, warring with a lifetime of obeying the orders of a superior officer. Farris sighs, and Harper watches the exchange with interest. Finally, Dex stalks out, slamming the door behind him. Tribesmen value their children above all else, I say to Farris. Use them as leverage, but don't hurt them. Keep Mamie and Sean alive. If we can't run Elias down, we might be able to use them to lure him in. If you learn anything, send me a message through the drums. When I leave the barracks to saddle my horse, I find Dex leaning against the stable wall. Before he can tear into me, I turn on him. What in the bleeding skies were you doing in there? I say. It's not enough that I have one of the Commandant's spies questioning my every move. I need you plaguing me too. He reports on everything you do, Dex says, but he doesn't question you. Even when he should. You're not focused. You should have seen that riot coming. You didn't see it coming. Even to my own ears, I sound like a petulant child. I'm not the Bloodstrike. You are! His voice rises, and he takes a level breath. You miss him. The edge in his voice fades. I miss him too. I miss all of them. Tristus, Demetrius, Leander. But they're gone. And Elias is on the run. All we have now, Shrike, is the Empire, and we owe it to the Empire to catch this traitor and execute him. I know that. Do you? Then why did you disappear for a quarter hour in the middle of the riot? Where were you? I stare at him long enough to make sure my voice doesn't shake. long enough for him to start thinking that he might have crossed a line. "Begin your hunt," I say quietly. "Don't leave a single wagon unsearched. If you find him, bring him in." We are interrupted by a step behind us. Harper, holding two scrolls with broken seals. "From your father and sister." He doesn't apologize for the fact that he's clearly read the missives. "Bloodstrike, we are well in Antium, though autumn's chill does not agree with your mother and sisters. I work to solidify the Emperor's alliances, but find myself thwarted. Gen Sicelia and Gens Rufia have put forth their own candidates for the throne. They attempt to rally other gens to their banners. The infighting has killed 50 in the capital, and it's just begun. Wildmen and barbarians have intensified their border attacks, and the generals on the front are in desperate need of more men. At least the Commandant has dampened the fire of the Scholar Revolution. When she was done, I am told, the River Rye ran red with scholar blood. She continues the cleansing in the lands north of Silas. Her victories reflect well on our Emperor, but better still upon her own gens. I hope to hear news of your success in tracking down the traitor Veturius soon. Loyal to the end. Pater Aquilus. P.S. Your mother asks that I remind you to eat." Livy's note is shorter. "My dear Hel, Antium is lonely with you so far away. Hannah feels it too, though she'd never admit it. His Majesty visits her nearly every day. He also inquires after my welfare, as I am still in isolation with a fever. Once he even attempted to bypass the guards and visit me. We are lucky our sister is marrying a man so dedicated to our family. The uncles and father try desperately to keep the old alliances strong, but the Illustrians do not fear His Majesty the way they should. I wish father would look to the plebeians for aid. I believe His Majesty's greatest supporters may lie there. Father calls for me to hurry, or I'd write more. Be safe, sister. With love, Livia Aquila." My hands shake as I roll the parchment up. Would that I'd received these messages a few days ago. Perhaps I would have realized the cost of failure and taken Elias into custody. Now what father feared has begun. The gens turn against each other. Hannah is that much closer to marrying the snake. And Marcus is trying to get to Livia. She never would have mentioned it if she didn't think it was significant. I crush the letters. Father's message is loud and clear. Find Elias. Give Marcus a victory. Help us. "Lieutenant Harper," I say. "Tell the men we move out in 5 minutes. Dex?" I can see from the stiff way that he turns to me that he's still angry. He has a right to be. "You'll handle the interrogations," I say. "Farris will search the desert to the east instead. Let him know. Get me answers, Dex. Keep Mamie and Sean alive in case we need them as bait. Otherwise, do what you must. Even in regard to the children." Dex nods, and I quash the sick feeling in the pit of my stomach at speaking the words. "I'm Bloodstrike. It is time to show my strength." "Nothing?" The three squad leaders fidget under my scrutiny. One stamps his foot in the sands, antsy as a penned stallion. Behind him, other soldiers in our encampment, some miles north of Ner, watch surreptitiously. "We've searched this blasted desert for 6 days, and we still have nothing?" Harper, the only one of the five of us not squinting from the punishing desert wind, clears his throat. "The desert is vast, Bloodstrike," he says. "We need more men." He's right. We must search thousands of wagons, and I have only 300 men to do it. I sent messages to Atella's Gap, as well as to the Tabe and Sard garrisons, requesting backup, but none has soldiers to spare. Strands of hair whip around my face as I pace before the soldiers. I want to send the men out once more before nightfall to search whatever wagons they find, but they are too exhausted. "There's a garrison a half-day's ride north in Gentrium," I say. If we push hard, we'll make it by nightfall. We can get reinforcements there. Evening nears as we approach the garrison, poking up over the top of a hill a quarter mile to the north. The outpost is one of the largest in the area, and straddles the forested lands of the Empire's interior and the tribal desert. Bloodshrike. Avitas shifts a hand to his bow and slows his horse when the garrison comes into view. Do you smell that? A western wind brings a whiff of something familiar and sour sweet to my nose. Death. My hand goes to my sim. An attack on the garrison? Scholar rebels? Or a barbarian sortie slipping through the Empire unnoticed because of the chaos elsewhere? I order the men forward, my body coiled, blood rising, yearning toward the battle. Perhaps I should have sent a scout ahead, but if the garrison needs our aid, there's no time for reconnaissance. We clear the hill and I slow the men. The road leading to the garrison is littered with the dead and dying. Scholars, not marshals. Far ahead, beside the garrison's gate, I see a row of six scholars kneeling. Before them paces a small figure, instantly recognizable, even at a distance. Carus Veturia. I nudge my horse forward. What in the bleeding hells is the commandant doing all the way out here? Has the revolution spread so far? My men and I pick our way carefully through the bodies left in haphazard piles. Some wear the black of resistance fighters, but most do not. So much death, all for a revolution that was doomed before it even began. Anger flares as I stare at the bodies. Didn't the scholar rebels understand what they would unleash when they revolted? Didn't they realize the death and terror the Empire would rain down upon them? I swing down from my horse at the garrison gate, a few yards from where the commandant observes her prisoners. Carus Veturia, her armor splashed with blood, ignores me. So do her men, who flank the scholar prisoners. As I draw myself up to reprimand them, Carus plunges her sim into the first scholar prisoner, a woman who crumples to the ground without so much as a whimper. I force myself not to look away. Bloodshrike. The commandant turns and salutes. Immediately her men follow suit. Her voice is soft, but as ever, she manages to mock my title, while keeping her face and expression flat. She glances at Harper, and he offers a bare nod in acknowledgement. Then she addresses me. Shouldn't you be scouring the lands to the south for Veturius? Shouldn't you be hunting scholar rebels along the River Rye? The revolution along the Rye has been crushed, the commandant says. My men and I have been purging the countryside of the scholar threat. I eye the prisoners shaking in terror before her. Three are twice my father's age. Two are children. These civilians do not look like rebel fighters to me. It is such thinking, Shrike, that encourages revolts in the first place. These civilians harbored resistance rebels. When brought to the garrison for questioning, they, along with the rebels, attempted to stage an escape. No doubt they were encouraged in their insurgency by rumors of a martial rout in Ner. I flush at her pointed remark, seeking a retort and finding none. Your failure has weakened the Empire. The words are unspoken, and they are not wrong. The commandant curls her lip and shifts her gaze over my shoulder to my men. A ragged bunch, she observes. Tired men make for failed missions, Bloodshrike. Did you not learn that lesson at Blackcliff? I had to divide my forces to cover more ground. Though I try to keep my voice as unfeeling as hers, I know I sound like a sullen cadet defending an unsound battle strategy to a centurion. So many men to hunt a traitor, she says. Yet you've had no luck. One would think you do not truly wish to find Veturius. One would be wrong, I grind out from a clenched jaw. One would hope, she says. with a soft derision that brings an enraged flush to my cheeks. She turns back to her prisoners. One of the children is next, a dark-haired boy with freckles across his nose. The sharp tang of urine permeates the air, and the commandant looks down at the boy and cocks her head. "Afraid, little one?" Her voice is almost gentle. "I want to retch at the lie in it." The boy trembles, staring at the blood-soaked dirt before him. "Stop!" I step forward. "Bleeding skies, what are you doing, Helene?" The commandant looks at me with a mild sort of curiosity. "As Bloodshrike," I say. "I order..." The commandant's first sim whistles through the air, divesting the child of his head. At the same time, she draws her second sim, plunging it through the heart of the second child. Knives appear in her hands, and she flings them, zing, 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 one by one into the throats of the last three prisoners. In the space of two breaths, she has executed them all. "Yes, Bloodshrike?" She turns back to me. On the surface, she is patient, attentive. No hint of the madness that I know roils deep within. I survey her men, well over 100 of them watching the altercation with cold-eyed interest. If I challenge her now, there is no telling what she will do. Attack, possibly, or try to butcher my men. She certainly won't submit to censure. "Bury the bodies." I suppress my emotions and flatten my voice. "I don't want the garrison's water supply contaminated by corpses." The commandant nods, her face still. The consummate mask. "Of course, Shrike." I order my men into the garrison and retire to the empty Blackguard barracks, dropping into one of the dozen hard bunks along the walls. I am filthy from a week on the road. I should bathe, eat, rest. Instead, I find myself staring at the ceiling for a solid 2 hours. I keep thinking of the commandant. Her insult to me was clear, and my inability to respond displayed my weakness. But though I'm upset by that, I'm more disturbed at what she did to the prisoners, at what she did to the children. Is this what the Empire has become? Or is this what it always was? A quiet voice within asks. "I brought you food." I jerk upright, hit my head on the bunk above me, and curse. Harper drops his pack on the floor and nods to a steaming plate of golden rice and spiced minced meat on a table by the door. It looks delicious, but I know that right now, anything I eat will taste of ashes. "The commandant left about an hour ago," Harper says. "She's headed north." Harper removes his armor, laying it neatly beside the door before digging around in the closet for fresh fatigues. He turns his back to me and changes. When he strips off his shirt, he steps into the shadows so I cannot see. I crack a smile at his modesty. "The food won't jump down your throat on its own, Shrike." I look suspiciously at the plate and Harper sighs, pads to the table in bare feet, and tastes the food before handing me the plate. "Eat," he says. "Your mother asked you to. How would it look if the Empire's Bloodshrike fainted dead away from starvation in the middle of a fight?" Reluctantly, I take the plate and force myself to chew a few morsels of it. "The old Bloodshrike had tasters." Harper sits on a bunk across from me and rolls his shoulders back. "Usually an orc soldier from some nameless plebeian family." "People tried to assassinate the Shrike?" Harper looks at me like I'm an especially dim yearling. "Of course. He had the Emperor's ear, and was first cousin to Korf's warden. There are probably only a handful of secrets in the Empire that he didn't know." I press my lips together to quell my shudder. I remember the warden from my time as a fiver. I remember how he got his secrets, through twisted experiments and mind games. Harper's eyes cut to me, and glitter like the pale jade of the southern lands. "Will you tell me something?" I swallow the bite I've only half chewed. That placidness in his tone, I've learned what it means. He's about to strike. "Why did you let him go?" "Bleeding skies." Let who go? I know when you're trying to mislead me,